In brief, Turing invented the digital computer. If anybody did, he played a major role in preventing a German invasion of Britain. And he was persecuted, arguably to death, for being gay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A UN commission puts queer rights on ice in Geneva, an anti-bias bill's passage puts the Philippines house in order, and we expose the enigmatic life of Alan Turing. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 14, 2005. This won't be the year the United Nations Commission on Human Rights declares that gay rights are human rights. The so-called Brazil resolution identifying discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity as human rights violations has been dropped from the agenda of the current commission meeting in Geneva, as it has each year since its introduction in 2003. But ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, takes heart from more countries than ever before calling on the UN to defend the human rights of sexual minorities, 33. ILGA and other international activists were a visible presence at the commission meeting, lobbying delegates and making a variety of presentations to highlight the issues.
Chile's parliament, the House of Deputies, has passed a resolution calling for government action on lesbian, gay, and trans civil rights. The national group Movil, the Homosexual Integration and Liberation Movement, drafted the text, which urges enactment of a law against discrimination and its vigorous enforcement. It also calls for a stronger response by police and courts to crimes motivated by homophobia.
In the Philippines House of Representatives, a bill to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity won committee approval this week. The same House Committee on Human Rights first greenlighted a similar bill in 2001, but activists are hoping this will be the year for enactment. Companion measures in the Senate have yet to be scheduled for a committee vote.
Scotland's parliament won't listen to anti-gay speeches by religious leaders. Parliamentary leaders adopted a policy 2 weeks ago against allowing addresses by clergy that attack minorities. They were responding to Roman Catholic Cardinal Keith O'Brien describing lesbian gays as captives to sexual aberration.
The Vatican continues to call on Spanish Catholics to take action against their government's bill to open marriage to gay and lesbian couples, a bill that's already passed one vote in Parliament. And now the Spanish Bishops' Organization has written to King Juan Carlos, demanding that he refuse to sign the bill and take a public stand against it. The Spanish monarchy doesn't actually have the power to stop any legislation and, by tradition, avoids political debate. But Spain's socialist prime minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, fired back at the church this week in his State of the Nation address, telling the parliament, "I will never understand those who proclaim love as the foundation of life while denying so radically protection, understanding, and affection to our neighbors, our friends, our relatives, our colleagues. What kind of love is this that excludes those who experience their sexuality in a different way? I'm aware that this measure is one of the most controversial we've approved, but we cannot deny a right to many of our compatriots when the exercise of that right does not harm anyone else."
Four Muslim imams took more direct action to stop a gay male couple's wedding in Zanzibar, and they're facing assault charges as a result. The imams burst in during the private ceremony on the island of Pemba and attacked the couple, reportedly beating both into unconsciousness. At last report, the imams had been denied bail and the couple were recuperating. But police are also investigating the possibility of criminal charges against the victims. Last year, Zanzibar enacted a law specifically criminalizing same-gender marriages and increasing penalties for homosexual acts, so the couple could potentially face up to 25 years imprisonment. That's more than the maximum any of their attackers might face.
A U.S. federal court this week struck down Nebraska's state constitutional amendment that denies gay and lesbian couples not only marriage, but anything remotely resembling it. District Judge Joseph Batallon is the first federal judge in the nation ever to strike down one of those state marriage amendments that are spreading across the U.S. like wildfire. The Nebraska amendment won its final approval from voters 5 years ago with a 70% majority. It's one of the broadest in the nation, going well beyond defining marriage as between one man and one woman, to denying legal recognition to same-gender civil unions, domestic partnerships, and any same-sex relationship similar to marriage. That very breadth contributed to its courtroom demise, as the ruling declared it would interfere with many other legitimate associations, arrangements, contracts, benefits, and policies, an almost limitless number of transactions and endeavors, and even with arrangements between potential adoptive or foster parents and children, related persons living together, and people sharing custody of children, as well as gay individuals. The ruling also labeled the amendment too narrow to satisfy its purported purpose of defining marriage, preserving marriage, or fostering procreation and family life, because it does not address other potential threats to the institution of marriage, such as divorce.
But the heart of the decision was that the Nebraska amendment violated lesbagays' constitutional right to equal protection under the law by making it impossible for them to lobby lawmakers to obtain legal protections for themselves or their children. That, the court found, imposed a broad disability on a single group, something the U.S. Supreme Court had already rejected when it struck down a Colorado state amendment barring local governments from extending civil rights protections to gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. The upshot is that lesbigays have not won the right to marry or contract domestic partnerships in Nebraska. They've won the right to try to make those gains through the normal political process. The lawsuit was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union and Lambda Legal on behalf of the groups Citizens for Equal Protection, Nebraska Advocates for Justice and Equality, and ACLU Nebraska, and their members. The lead defendant is Nebraska's Attorney General John Bruning, who has vowed to appeal the decision and vigorously defend the amendment. In the eyes of some of the leading proponents of amending the U.S. National Constitution to restrict marriage to one man and one woman, this week's ruling is more fuel for their fire, as they're confirmed in their belief that no other measure for marriage discrimination will survive the justice system.
U.S. activists are also celebrating a few changes to the advice the Bush administration is giving parents via the Department of Health and Human Services website. An area designed to help parents speak with their children about sex, www.number4parents.gov, has had some 5 million hits in its first month, but what it had to say regarding sexual orientation offended many lesbigays and was sharply criticized by groups including the Human Rights Campaign. The site reflects the administration's promotion of abstinence and denigration of condoms and other contraceptives, and still certainly doesn't treat sexual minority and questioning youth as might PFLAG, parents, families, and friends of lesbians and gays. But at least now the department has learned that the term alternative lifestyles is outdated, although the word lifestyle still appears on the site. It no longer seems to assume that every family of a questioning child automatically requires professional help, and it acknowledges for these children, as it already did for others, the importance of parents expressing their love and acceptance.
And finally, scientific research into the biology of sexuality has turned to the sense of smell. In a study published this week in the U.S. journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a team at Sweden's Karolinska University Hospital tested the responses of heterosexual women, heterosexual men, and gay men to two chemicals that might be human pheromones. They're also studying lesbians, but say those results are complicated and incomplete, although different from gay men's. Using PET scans, positron emission tomography, the researchers were able to examine how subjects' brains responded to smells. Their control scents, including lavender oil, cedar oil, and butanol, stimulated only the olfactory region of the brain in all the subjects. The possible pheromones, an estrogen-related chemical found in female urine called EST, and a testosterone derivative found in male sweat called AND, drew different responses from the heterosexual men than they did from the gay men and the heterosexual women. along with the olfactory brain response. Among the heterosexual men, the female EST additionally stimulated a part of the hypothalamus associated with sexual behavior. Neither the heterosexual women nor the gay men showed that hypothalamic response to EST, but they did have a hypothalamic response to the male AND, which the heterosexual men did not. Although this study clearly associates a biological process with sexual orientation, lead researcher Dr. Ivanka Savic cautioned that the Karolinska study does not determine whether the difference it found is a cause or an effect of orientation. It's possible that gay men, in the words of the report, have an acquired sensitization to AND stimuli in the hypothalamus due to repeated sexual exposure to men. The Karolinska team also noted that they were exposing subjects to far higher concentration of EST and AND than they'd be apt to encounter in real life.
But another study has already examined reactions to underarm sweat, the source for AND, and it suggests that gaydar may be in the nose. Charles Wysocki and a team at the Monell Chemical Sense Center in Philadelphia had heterosexual men and women and lesbians and gay men rate their preferences among 24 sweat samples from equally diverse donors. As will be published in the September edition of Psychological Science, they found that the sweat of gay men was the least preferred by all the subject groups, except the gay men, who liked it best.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 14, 2005. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, reviews of LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. You can also demonstrate your solidarity by taking part in an online benefit auction. Look for the This Way Out area at alternabid.com. Again, to find out more about special CD thank you gifts, subscriptions, and the auction, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA.
Europe's recent ceremonies observing the end of World War II remind This Way Out producer Hugh Young of one of the heroes of the Allied victory, and without whom today's computers might not exist. With presenter Barry Empson, Hugh answers the questions, who was Alan Turing? And, most probably, why haven't I heard of him?
Well, you might ask. And the probability that you don't know is an important part of his story. In brief, Turing invented the digital computer, if anybody did. He played a major role in preventing a German invasion of Britain. And he was persecuted, arguably to death, for being gay. Alan Turing's father, Julius, was in the Indian Civil Service, administering most of South India. But in 1907, he was on the way home on leave when he met Ethel Stoney. She had attended Cheltenham Ladies' College, whose principals, Miss Buss and Miss Beale, are still remembered in the rhyme.
Miss Buss and Miss Beale, Cupid's darts do not feel. Oh, how different from us are Miss Beale and Miss Buss.
Ethel did feel Cupid's dart, and she married Julius and returned to India with him the following year. They were on leave again when Alan was born, in Paddington. They returned to India again, and Alan was virtually brought up by other old India hands, rather stiffly and unimaginatively. In 1926, he began secondary schooling at Sherborne. Alec Waugh wrote the classic gay novel The Loom of Youth about Sherborne. His first and almost his only love affair was there with Christopher Morcombe, who was 1 year older. The relationship was probably never consummated. They shared an interest in mathematics, and Christopher gained a scholarship to Trinity College, Cambridge, while Alan failed. But in early 1930, Christopher died of tuberculosis. Alan was heartbroken. A second attempt at Trinity also failed, but he gained a scholarship to King's instead.
The sun on the meadow is summery warm. The stag in the forest runs free.
In 1934, he visited Germany. He was in Hanover on June the 30th, the night of the Long Knives, when the SA was overthrown and its head, Ernst Röhm, was dragged from his lover's bed and shot as a filthy pervert. Hitler gained supreme power, and it was the end of the decadent Germany that Christopher Isherwood had celebrated. Many people around the world, not yet aware of the extent of Hitler's evil, rejoiced. That year, aged only 22, Turing was made a Fellow of King's. He worked on the question, what is the most general type of cipher or code possible? And closely related, the most general kind of machine to deal with symbols. Starting from a typewriter, he developed the idea of what is now called a Turing machine, a machine that could read and write marks on an endless paper tape, and given the proper programming, carry out any operation on symbols. In 1937, he completed his major work, Computable Numbers, which laid the basis for computers as we know them. He also concerned himself with the practicalities, experimenting with gear wheels and electrical relays, getting his hands dirty in a way not customary to Cambridge dons.
I hope, it's home from where we go.
It became clear to the world that war was inevitable. But in October 1938, he and a friend found some escape in the new Disney film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Alan was very taken with the scene in which the Wicked Witch dangled an apple on a string into a boiling brew of poison, muttering,
"Dip the apple in the brew, let the sleeping death seep through."
He liked to chant the couplet over and over. September 1939. And he reported the day after war was declared to the GC and CS, the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire. Now Turing's speculations on ciphers came into their own. The German Navy and Air Force used a code known as Enigma. Unlike other codes of the day, Enigma was easy to use. Sender and receiver had identical, fairly simple machines with keyboards. They systematically changed one letter of the alphabet for another, like the simple codes we played with as children. But the Enigma machines changed the code after every letter. Obviously, if your enemy also has a machine, they can read your messages. That is, if they start at the same position. To increase the number of possible starting positions, the Germans added various refinements. But they changed their starting position only once a day. The code was solved by finding a pattern in the traffic of each day that betrayed that day's starting position. This was done mechanically, at first using punched cards carrying all possible patterns, later using a large number of machines that stepped through all possible positions in a short time. In February 1941, a German trawler was captured off Norway and the commanding officer killed before he could destroy a set of Enigma instructions. This enabled the GC and CS to read all naval traffic for that month, and by May, they were deciphering messages within a day. By June, the same day. So, Turing's work proved vital in the war in the Atlantic. In the spring of 1941, Alan proposed to another cryptanalyst, Joan Clark. He warned her he had homosexual tendencies, which was less than the truth. Eventually, he decided that it couldn't work and broke it off. He was known around the park as the Prof, even though they were all academics there. Among his eccentricities, he was unconcerned with his appearance, held his pants up with whatever came to hand, shaved with an early electric razor, leaving a 5 o'clock shadow. In the hay fever season, he wore a handkerchief over his nose. He could be abrupt, not suffering fools gladly. Turing's work on Enigma ended with a whimper rather than a bang, and he went to America to liaise with their cryptanalysts. His security rating was the highest. In America, he worked on speech encoding. The method he used is now commonplace, digital sampling, like the code on compact discs, only with mathematical operations on the digits to disguise them. The day the war ended, a friend said, "Now you can tell us everything." Turing said, "Don't be silly." And he never did. But his work on codes proved valuable at the National Physical Laboratory at Teddington when he worked on the automatic computing engine, or universal machine, what was known then as the electronic brain, and what we would call a computer. He showed that with a large, fast memory, the hardware could be very simple. There didn't need to be a special part of the computer to add or multiply, just a set of instructions in the program to use more basic instructions as often and as necessary for addition or multiplication to occur. In fact, a computer just needed to imitate adding or multiplying. If the symbols 1 plus 1 times 2 times 3 were always decoded as 12, that was enough. In the same way, the computer was imitating human thinking, and the Turing test is still used today in considering the unsolved question, can a machine think? Can a machine fool a human into thinking he or she is communicating with another human? However, because of his personality, he found it hard to communicate what was so clear to him to engineers or even lesser mathematicians, and the bureaucracy got in the way. One of Turing's superiors cheerfully stripped the logic functions from the proposed computer, turning it into a giant calculator. The outcome is history. The early development of computers fell to the Americans, and by 1950, Turing was being written out of the history of the computer. Turing machine is sometimes written with an umlaut, as if it were German. Turing. Turing went on with his own ideas, which he called abbreviated code instructions, and we would call high-level languages. He saw, as few people did then, that a computer was not confined to numbers. One of his recreations was programming a computer to imitate that uniquely mathematical and uniquely English art form, change ringing. He wrote short stories, thinly disguised autobiography. One mentions picking up another gay man. In using that word, as in so much else, he was years ahead of his time. Late in 1951, Alan picked up Arnold Murray, 19, working class, but not rough trade exactly, vivacious and with a sense of humor. On their second meeting, Alan took him home and they spent the night together, and two more nights together. Arnold was poor, but he wouldn't accept money directly. On the 23rd of January 1952, Alan's house was burgled. Arnold said a friend, Harry, had done it. Alan, with typical innocence, went to the police and described Harry to them. And when they questioned him further about how he knew, he blurted out just about everything. Alan Matheson Turing, being a male, and Arnold Murray, being a male, were convicted of 1. Committing an act of gross indecency, plus 1. Being a party to the commission of an act of gross indecency, times 2 men, times 3 nights, a total of 12 sexual crimes, and that was enough. Turing wouldn't parade his war record, considering it irrelevant. If anything, his class counted against him. Arnold was conditionally discharged. Turing was bound over not to repeat his crime and offered the choice of prison or organotherapic treatment, as the local paper put it. Turing didn't want to stop work, and accepted the treatment. Female hormones. They made his breasts grow and made him impotent, although not desire-free. He interpreted the instruction not to repeat his crime literally and went overseas, to Norway and Greece, for sexual contact. After a year, Alan had a doctor remove the hormone implant from his thigh. One of its effects, at least in rats, is as a cerebral depressant. The experiment wasn't repeated on many humans, so whether it produces depression in the ordinary sense is unclear. 10 months later, with no warning whatever, on June the 7th, 1954, Alan Turing dipped an apple in a brew, let the sleeping death seep through, and bit the apple. His mother refused to believe it was suicide. He had often used potassium cyanide in his experiments. One was still brewing in another room. Perhaps he arranged it this way to spare her feelings. There's no memorial, unless you count every computer in the world. One enigma remains. What would computers be like today if Alan Turing hadn't killed himself? Well, as another gay Cambridge mathematician, Ludwig Wittgenstein, said, "Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen." Of what we cannot speak, thereof must we be silent.
The Enigmatic Life of Alan Turing was narrated by Barry Empson. It was written and produced by Hugh Young, who also programmed the music on a Commodore 128. It was based on the book Alan Turing, The Enigma, by Andrew Hodges. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, and Hugh Young and Barry Empson contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime, online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. You can also email tworadio@aol.com to ask for our monthly This Way Out updates and or to receive our weekly program promo messages. That's tworadio@aol.com. This Way Out is supported by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please find out how you can help keep us on the air and get our tangible thanks by visiting our website. You can also bid on some terrific items at an online auction sponsored by the Stonewall Society to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out area at alternabid.com. And to be sure you don't miss a week of This Way Out, you can subscribe to audio CDs of our program. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, KBOO Portland, Oregon, WHRW Binghamton, New York, and more than 150 other stations around the world. And we know you'll stay tuned.